as the 11th commandment. And actually, I'll go a little beyond committee work. I'll have some introductory comments first, then deal somewhat with committees, with planning, with high payoff tasks versus priority, high priority tasks, and with delegation. Now that's if time permits, and if we get that far. If there is some information given out that is not clear, I'd welcome you to raise your hand and ask questions as we go along. At the village, we deal a lot with stewardship, with concern for non-renewable resources, and time fits under that tent, I think, very well, because personal time for each of us is a non-renewable resource, and whether or not, and how we manage our time really relates closely to whether or not we are good stewards of the time that we have been given. And Jesus said in one part of a verse, you know, be as wise as serpents. And I'd like to put that in the connotation also of how you handle, use your own time. We can use time efficiently, but I'm not talking just about that, because I can very efficiently use my time doing the wrong things. And so the effective use of time is also of importance to me. All of us are managers of our time. Now, admittedly, as I move along, some of this will relate more directly to the management of time and to managers, possibly, in business. Although housewives are managers, mothers are managers. And in one sense, the concepts behind some of the things that will be shared, I think, will be appropriate to everyone. About a year ago, I was noticing some of the graffiti in the men's lavatory in the College of Education, University of Oregon. And one statement that I'd like to share with you was, we're all losers, but some of us are better at it than others. And I think that fits the situation almost with time. We all don't manage it as well as we wish to, but some of us have greater problems with it than others. A few introductory comments first. Someone has said, I always seem to run out of the day before I run out of things to be done. Then Alec McKenzie, who is an authority on the management of time, has said, the paradox of time is that few people have enough, yet everyone has all that there is. If you want to sit down anywhere, if you find the floor, why, feel free to do so. Another one, Alec McKenzie polled 1,000 managers, and only 1 in 100 of those claimed that they had enough time during the day. Seneca said many years ago, a man who has taken your time recognizes no debt, yet it is the one he can never repay. Napoleon made this comment, there is one kind of robber whom the law does not strike at, and who steals what is most precious to man, and that is time. Then there's a Swedish fellow named Sunni Carlson who has made a study of management, and he said, too often a manager is a puppet whose strings are drawn by a crowd of unknown and unorganized people. Ever feel that way? Now, if I'm an authority on time management at all, it's the same type of an authority that a person in Alcoholics Anonymous is. You know, the one who's the greatest help has been there. And I've been in management work of one type or another most of my life. And the things I'm going to share, many of them are the things that I have made the same mistakes, and that's, I think, the reason for my interest in the area. But back to the first topic we're going to touch on, that is committee meetings. I think many of us have guilt feelings if we don't go to a committee meeting. Now, kind of regardless of who calls it, regardless almost of what the topic is, maybe regardless of the experience you've had with that committee in the past, you can feel kind of guilty if you don't go. I'd like to suggest that that we might want to feel guilty if we attend. Now, if we attend meetings that are not planned, that are not productive, and so on, that we have a responsibility more than bringing our body there. We have a responsibility for bringing our mind there also, and helping accomplish something. And if you're going to meetings where you sit and someone talks at you at a meeting where you're to plan or discuss or something, maybe you should feel guilty for going to that type of a meeting. Someone else made a study specifically of reactions to meetings, and he studied 200 groups that met. 75% of the people, 3 out of 4, said that half the time was wasted. Now, what does that say, you see, then, to the stewardship of time, to the stewardship of a non-renewable resource that we have been given by God, if we are one of the 3 out of 4 who feel that half the time we sit in meetings is wasted? Someone said that an organization in which everyone meets all the time is an organization in which no one gets very much done. Okay, let's then look at some suggestions in this particular area of committee meetings.
Yes? I keep thinking the same thing applies to classes as committees.
You're suggesting that classes fall under the same category as
right,
committees.
Right.
Yeah, I think much of this will. That's a good point, Bert. Okay, the first one then is either providing, if you're responsible for a committee meeting, or requesting or insisting upon an advance agenda. I've heard people say, you know, it's really ridiculous to come to this meeting and not know what's going to take place. How can I think about it? How can I plan in advance if I don't know what's going to happen? An agenda is an evidence of planning, which would give some idea that the purpose of that meeting is clearly understood in the minds of the person who called it. And then if you have an agenda, you can tell whether or not you're proceeding along the path rather than moving. Well, it's kind of like Larry Collins talks about how these valleys are formed. If it's glacial, it's kind of a straight down action. If it's formed by water, it's a meandering action, and many committees take that kind of a meandering action without any specific agenda direction. Then I think most committees are too large. In other words, make your committees smaller. You can relate this to boards also. I've worked on the board at PLU when it was 12 in number. Anybody from PLU here now? Well, anyway, the board now, I think the last time I was there, and I'm not on the board now, I think there must have been 35 people in the room. Now, they're representatives of this group and representatives of that group, which is probably, you know, all right in one way. But if I say one thing during the day, I've had my turn. You know, my mind may be working, but you feel like you're hogging things after a while. The same thing's happened at Emmanuel Hospital in Portland. There used to be 12. Now I think they're about, you know, 20-some. Holden Village has kind of gotten around it by a technique which I think is helpful. They have a corporation board of 20, 22, something like that. And then they have a board of trustees which meets the day following of about 10 or so. And that board transacts the business, and there's an opportunity for more discussion that way. But why do we have big committee meetings? Well, one of the reasons, I think, is if we don't invite everybody in this room, someone will feel slighted. You know, maybe we all belong to the same church, and we don't want to slight Mike over here, so, you know, we're not going to talk about Mike's field, but anyway, we invite him because we don't want to slight anybody. And then, if you've got a large group, the chances are, you know, if your boss is there or the president of the synod is there, what if you sit all day and you don't say anything or all meeting? They'll think, well, you know, let's not invite Vern again because he didn't contribute. But maybe Vern's one of the best minds, but he had a feeling that he wasn't necessarily in tune with this particular topic. So you find some people in large groups giving speeches that will impress other people. And then you don't, with a large group, you really don't find time for everyone to express their thinking. Here's some floor over here. It's difficult for everyone to get a chance to express their feeling. For example, if this were a committee meeting right here, it'd be pretty hard for all of us to have some input. Now, these suggestions, you know, are not universal. You'll need to select from them those which seem appropriate in your own areas. But another suggestion regarding meetings is to limit the minutes to, you know, three things: what happened, who is to take some action, and by what date. How many times do you see minutes that look like court recordings? You know, so-and-so said this and so-and-so said this. In my opinion, it's even good with the minutes to move the minutes into the right two-thirds of the page and put the person's name who is responsible on the left two-thirds of the page. You know, if there's a certain action to be taken, you know, then put Bob over here or whatever it is, and then when he gets a copy of the minutes, he knows next time they're going to ask, you know, Bob, what did you do in this area? Set it out that way, I think, is very helpful. Then the length of meetings gets to be a real problem. I think it was last night when Al Pitcher said that he attended some meetings until 3 or 4 in the morning and they never got anywhere. I work with lots of school boards in the state of Oregon, and there are some who can do their business in an hour and a half or 2 hours and quit, and there's some who go on till midnight, and they're really into areas that are not their responsibility. Some wag has said the way to cut your meeting short is to take 2 inches off the front of the two front legs of every chair. Yeah. And you know, maybe we make our chairs too comfortable. You go to some meetings and you get in a soft chair and you can recline, you know, you sit there comfortably all day. Another fellow, I've heard this several times, and I finally met one fellow who does it. He calls some stand-up meetings. He calls people in and he has a meeting. He doesn't ask them to sit down, and he says they get through pretty fast. Another good idea that may be more practical as far as you're concerned is to call a meeting, you know, 11:15 in the morning, or call a meeting at 4 in the afternoon, or call it before, you know, dinner time or something like that. You give people dinner and then you call a meeting, you know, you go on and on kind of indefinitely. So there are ways and techniques to schedule meetings and try to make them shorter. Then there is another technique that I like very well that gets around this idea of having to call everybody together in this particular group to discuss something. And that's a form that's used that goes something like this. I have asked Werner, Howard, and Al to meet with me on Wednesday at 10 o'clock in Koinonia to discuss the possible installation of a second generator at the water plant. And this is a written notice that I would get. Please come if you need information or want to participate in the discussion. Now, I've been invited. Now, if I want to come, I come. If I want to stay away, I can stay away. The rest of it says, either way, you will get a prompt summary of the discussion and any decision reached together with a request for your comments. Now, if they, in their best judgment, come up with a recommendation, and it looks good, you know, why did I need to sit there? If I think there's some question, or you think there's some question about it, that they've forgotten a certain pertinent fact, you have a chance before this gets set in concrete to, you know, get back to them and say, hey, did you think about the fact that, you know, the hill slides a little bit and the pipe may break or whatever it is. So they have the benefit of your thinking. I find more of people knowing about this little technique, using it, and getting together the few people necessary, because usually, if it's a business meeting, a couple of people or three people and a secretary can accomplish more in an hour than, you know, a large group can do all morning. Then, once in a while, the converse can be true. You can have committees that meet and act too quickly. Decisions should not be just nitty-gritty decisions. They should be more, you know, basic policy decisions. And oftentimes you can get in a meeting and you're tired or you're in a hurry And that the attitude kind of prevails is, let's get this thing decided and go home, or do the next thing, you know. And this can be done before the issues are really clarified. And before, you know, you can really resolve things on the basis of looking at what are the alternative courses of action, you know, what are the pros and cons of these courses of action, and then choosing that which best meets the need. And so we get in the position oftentimes of saying, you know, let's vote on this. And if I can get a 55% to 45% majority, that settles it. Well, you know, it settles it according to Robert's Rules of Order. But you've got a large minority that is unhappy, that remains probably resentful, and remains uncommitted to the action that has been selected. So I'd like to stress the fact that every majority at one time, you know, was a minority. Every idea that's popular today at one time was an unpopular idea, or at least in the minority. And this would be kind of a three-star suggestion, and that is that a committee owes it to the minority, whether it's one person or three persons or whatever it is, to accurately paraphrase the position of the minority before you vote. Because if Mike again has got a position, I mean, we all think we should, you know, go north. And Mike's got a position that we really don't understand. He hasn't presented it, so we understand it. One of us should be able to so paraphrase his thinking that he says, yeah, that's what I mean. And then we can say either, you know, well, if that's what you mean, we thought so, but we still want to go north. Or we might say, hey, we didn't really understand what Mike is saying. I think we better go northwest, because considering what he's saying, you see. So any committee, I think, owes it to the minority to paraphrase its position clearly to their satisfaction and then move ahead with whatever decision is to be made. Now, there are those also, and this would apply probably more to business, or it could apply to church councils too, if you're having ever a series of meetings, not always to take action at the first meeting, but to, for the reason that some people talk quickly and give their opinions quickly, and others are more deliberative type of individuals. And the next morning, they'll say, hey, you know, I was thinking about what we were talking about last night, and you know, maybe it wouldn't be a good idea, and so on. So there are some business managers who say, you know, don't go with the first idea. Kind of hold off. It's a major policy thing. Let those who are a little more deliberative have a chance to think about this. I'm going to open a window here. Air Force. I think there are a lot of people in here. I don't know if that one opens up the back of you or not, Mike. Be a little helpful. Okay, then another thing that I think is helpful, the chairman doesn't always have to chair the meeting. I have an assistant in the bureau, and I ask Walt to chair the meetings most of the time. This allows me to kind of sit back, listen, find out, you know, who has the ideas. I can comment if I wish to. I can kind of help also maybe keep on the agenda if there is a problem that way. So don't necessarily feel that, you know, the chairman needs to do this. Pass that job around to others who might be capable. And then this is what I call a three-star idea. And a lot of these are not new to you. I think we often need to be reminded more than instructed on these things. But that's the concept of the task force versus the committee. The committee structure, I think, seriously maimed, if didn't kill, PTA. Now, I was on the state PTA board in Oregon for many years, and I think a lot of the PTA. But they have a committee structure from A to Z, you know, and you plug bodies into, you know, so many into this group, and so many into this group, and so many into this group, and it's just kind of that's the job, you know, oftentimes, you know, plugging bodies into these groups. And no one really stops to ask, you know, what is this group going to do? Why is it important? Do we need this group this year? And so on. On the other side, it seems to me that if you have a task force, you need something done, and whether or not you are, you know, a major board of a dozen people and you need something done, rather than the dozen people sitting around trying to decide, you know, what should be done, pick out the three of them right here who know the most about this topic. And make them a task force to study this the various possibilities and so on, and bring their recommendation back to the committee for its action later. A task force, by the beauty of it, is once it's finished its job, it's disbanded. You know, when you make your report, you're disbanded. I think this is an incentive to get the work done. And I'm not going to quite hesitate to be on a task force as opposed to being on a committee that, you know, let's see, when did they start? 5 years ago? What are they for? And this type of thing. And then, as I suggest too, you can select experts to do that type of work. Then again, if in a committee a few tend to dominate the discussion, and I think that's kind of typical, you know, that a few people have most of the ideas, I like to go around the group sometimes and say, you know, well, we haven't heard from, you know, these people over here and so on. Let's give everybody a chance for an input on this. It's been my experience sometimes that the most knowledgeable people remain the most silent. Well, that's a generalization that maybe wouldn't hold up. But I think of a classic example. One of our doctoral students from Canada was John Hernard, and when we got, before he came, I saw his Miller analogy test score, and the highest you're supposed to get is 99th percentile, you know, and this came from headquarters, 99 plus 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 percent, you know. Well, he must have blown the top of the thing. When we sat in meetings, John normally wouldn't contribute, and I'd call on John. I'd say, hey, John, you know, you owe it to us to share your thinking. Individually, I would say that to him. And I'd call on him sometime in meetings. He'd have real good ideas. Some of you may have done this NASA consensus-seeking experiment. You've done this where you get a group and you'd have to decide what items you'd rank order the items to save yourself on the moon to get from this spot to this spot. I've seen time and again where on the individual score, one person will get a good high score on that, and that will be much higher than the group score. Now, there's only one answer. The group did not tap the resources in its own, you know, little group, by getting that person's knowledge and information. Some of the more vocal people apparently gave their thinking, and this other person thought, well, maybe they'll laugh at me if I say something, or maybe they won't believe me, or I didn't get a chance to get in, and there was no input. And if the group had gone around and asked, you know, someone could have said, hey, you know, you need this and this and so on this particular life-saving trip on the moon. So I think it's very important to be sure that everyone has a chance for input on major decisions. Then maybe a more technical point of view in a way comes from, I was on an American Management Association briefing seminar recently, and I listened to the fellow ahead of me, and he had a concept that I hadn't heard of before. He used a chalkboard in a meeting when discussing a problem, and to improve the quality of the input, he had three columns on there. Well, he had more than that, but the three major columns, after he listed the problem, you know, on the left side, then the next column was for opinions, and the next column was for personal experience, and the next column was for, you know, hard data of some type. And so we're discussing a problem, you see, and I say, well, you know, I think that such and such is the case. He put it up there, but under the opinion column, see. Vern might have had some experience in the area, and he'd say, well, this is my experience. Okay, you know, that would go in the second column, and so on. And then if someone could get some data that would relate to the problem, that would go in this column over here. And he said it kind of helped before too many meetings to keep people from just, you know, throwing their opinions out without any basis in fact at all. So this
and
could...
And that with Bible study too.
Okay. Have you done that? Or do you...
A little bit like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not three columns, two columns. But you can get a lot of suggestions and sort out the suggestions and get... So the ranking of the classifying of responses is great.
And the classifying of responses tends then to encourage these responses rather than just off the cuff opinions, huh? Yeah.
Well, it also gets the opinions out, and then you see what you haven't done.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
It gets you to the second act quicker.
Uh-huh. Okay, there are some other areas that I want to touch on, but there may be some of you here who have some ideas relating to meeting specifically, some ideas that have been helpful for you. Is there anyone who wants to throw an idea out like that? Yes.
I think, in my opinion, is a good process, unless it's a purpose. Meaning, its purpose is to rubber stamp something you're going to do anyway.
Yes.
And if it's a group process, then one of the things I think is helpful to suck everybody out right off, so nobody lays back and doesn't offer, is to do something very quickly. It sometimes takes a couple minutes. That is a group process kind of thing, where everybody can make a comment or share a something. You know, simple little things like, say there's 10 of you. Hey, real quick, let's go around the room. Share something good that's happened to you today, just real quick. You lead off and model it, next person goes. Everybody has now said something and has broken the ice, and you can slide from some kind of process thing like that, you know, into your business in a very easy kind of way.
So the encouragement then of getting everybody to participate early will encourage everyone to feel like they can participate later.
But it can be participation in a very non-threatening way.
Yes.
It can be something almost gamey.
Mm-hmm.
To begin with.
Okay, good.
But somehow it takes very, very little amount of time, but it begins the group process.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Bert?
One of the devices we used for what we're cutting down on committees was to use coordinators. We started 1 year saying, well, never have a committee do what a single person can do. And chairman appointed a number of coordinators, leaving it sort of open so that if you have an idea and if you want to help on that, go see the coordinator. And it's amazing how much got done, and there weren't committees created, because each an individual took it. They knew they could have a committee if they wanted, or they could have a task force, and now and then there were task forces that operated in conjunction with coordinators, but a single person was responsible.
Okay, fine. And you could even have a committee could even do that, I guess. If you know, we were appointed to a committee, we could say, hey, Vern, will you be the coordinator on the routine, the normal things? Please handle it. If you come up across a problem, then
help.
Call us together.
Yeah.
But don't call us together every time.
Now, I got a question, really. What one of our major hang-ups is that as a faculty group, we really love to talk, you know. We can argue about something. There's something very satisfying about this, you know. And you know, that's good. We enjoy it, and it's partly a hobby and partly serious. And, and it really doesn't make any difference. So one of our hang-ups was that we get really elaborate discussions of fairly administrative implementation. How do you keep the agenda focused on policy rather than on implementation and administration, which any one of the persons could do a better job of by themselves?
I don't know that I have an easy answer, but it would seem to me that if any committee is interested in its process, that it should appoint an observer to say, you know, at the beginning, if we are here to work on policy rather than administrative trivia, that then let us ask Mike to be our observer. And when we get off the track, you know, he pounds on the table and says, you know, if you want to stay on this, okay, but you ought to know this is what you're doing. You're right. We like to talk sometimes, like to hear ourselves talk in committee meetings.
So a process observer like a Robert's Rules of Order.
Could be. Okay, is there anyone else? Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay, a couple more and then we'll move ahead.
Oh, yes. I worked at Christian Education, and we made a major policy change here about a year ago. And we used a device that was, I don't know, it just accidentally happened, but it worked quite well. What we did is we called about 40 of the Sunday school teachers together, which is quite a committee group.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get, you know, we presented the policy change, you know, and allowed questions, and then we gave them a sheet of paper that had a section that listed the advantages and a section that listed the disadvantages. And we broke them up into little groups and for more discussion. And together they discussed the advantages of the change, then the disadvantages. With one difference, in the disadvantages, we asked them to say, now, is this disadvantages, is it good or is it bad? And, you know, even a disadvantage can be good.
Mm-hmm.
And when we took the vote, we had 100% for the policy change. Because we took a disadvantage and made it positive.
Yeah. Okay, that's...
And when we took the vote, we had 100% for the policy change. Because we took a disadvantage and made it positive.
Yeah. Okay, that's a real good idea, and I think that's one way of using a large group, even though you broke them into small groups, because the homework, in a sense, was done ahead of time. Had you called the 40 together and said, now let's think about developing a policy, that could have taken a very long time.
Yeah, no, you could do it that way.
So that was a reaction, too. Very good. Yeah, two more over here. And then we'll...
We have a volunteer group of some 20 people, and in serving them, we had not done a good job of preparing agendas or really giving them things to do, so they're getting frustrated. So the past year, we broke them down into three or four groups and had them pick the area they were going to work on, then used our main meetings for reports from the different subgroups that had accomplished things. We'd prepare an agenda in advance and prioritize the items that we wanted accomplished. And under the rules we adopted, the meeting ended at 9:30 unless there was a motion to suspend the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So if we got on a low priority item and everyone would go home, 9:30, we were out of there. If we were really into something, people had a chance to say, hey, let's stay on this.
Okay.
And it improved our attendance and our production.
When you know there's a terminal time, I think you do a lot better. It's like if you go to a psychiatrist and he says, this is $50 an hour, you know, you want to talk pretty fast. Okay?
The last suggestion reminded me of the disproportionate influence of having something on paper. Many committees or groups will get together and spend the first half an hour trying to decide why they're there, what the purpose is, and what the problem is. If that can be clarified, I found that, and this can be abused too, but the person who comes prepared with something on paper and lets the discussion gets going a little bit and said, well, here's, for whatever it's worth, here's an idea, you pass it around and it may have five steps to a problem or something. Typically about 80% of the final solution will be related to the, to the first idea. Now, they use it in terms of structuring it in rather than waiting for one of those 40 teachers to pass the paper around, but it speeds up the process, and it's just a technique of getting your own ideas adopted if you take your purpose.
If you say you want to be influential at a committee meeting, you'd want to bring something ahead of time.
Maybe. Anything that's on paper about 80% of it will end up in the final.
Which really means the rest of us, you know, if we didn't bring it, ought to look at it pretty carefully, too, rather than glom onto it and say, here is our way out of the meeting in a short order. Okay, I'd like to, that's a good point. I'd like to go on to a couple of other things because they relate to this and very closely. One is planning. And why is there so little planning done? Well, I think it's because we considered it important but not urgent. And we plan to plan when there's nothing else to be done. And so, you know, planning kind of gets put off. We tend to put out today's fires and give that priority out of planning for ahead of planning for tomorrow. And then if we do get around to planning, we may think, well, we'll sit down for 2 minutes and let's plan. And you can't really do productive planning in a real short time. Those who work in this area generally suggest you need to block out about an hour and a half if you're with someone, if you're really going to sit down and do some careful planning. And this means that you don't answer the phone, the secretary doesn't put through a call, or at home you take the phone off the hook, because you know we're conditioned by Ma Bell, like Pavlov conditioned his dog. You know, that rings and everybody goes for that little black or colored instrument there. And I talked to someone yesterday who said at dinner time and other times they take their phone off the hook, and I admire that family. And if you're in an office by yourself, you know, you may have to do the same thing.
For 25 cents a month, you can get a cutoff.
For 25 cents a month?
25 cents.
Well, you can either invest 25 cents a month in a cutoff or lift it off. But right. That's worth it. That'd be very much worth it. Okay, Alex McKenzie, who I consider one of the experts on time management, says that every hour spent in effective planning saves 3 or 4 in execution and gets better results. Now let's get back to thinking about the stewardship of time and being wise as serpents and our non-renewable resource. Think then in relation to an hour spent in effective planning, saving 3 or 4 and getting better results, both. And still, we're kind of afraid to plan oftentimes for a reason that we don't distinguish too well. When you're planning, it's decision-making for the future. And between where I sit now and the future, there is a sea of uncertainty. And, you know, the more of a perfectionist I am, the more right I want that decision to be out there, and the less I want to make a wrong decision. And therefore, this sea of uncertainty is a greater threat. And so I think some people, if they're perfectionists, you know, will probably postpone and postpone and postpone decision-making. Someone has said the sooner you make a decision, the longer time you have to correct it if it's wrong. Well, I don't advise that, but it seems to me that we have to get to a point where we are willing to take some risks. Say, I don't know all about it, but I know the area of information that's lacking, and I'll continually monitor this, you know, future planning decision on the basis of, will I get more information in this area where the data is lacking? Then I think you can go ahead a little more carefully. In my own situation, I have gotten, after years and years of having my agenda, my calendar, you know, kind of at the demand of other people, or the minute-by-minute phone call, or whatever it is, I've gotten around to the point where I block out, my calendar has 8:30 to 10 in the morning X'd out, and that's for planning. And in fact, I even have a little switch on my desk and a light outside, and I've got a red and amber light out there, and when that red light is on, they don't disturb me. Now, originally I used to think, well, what will people think, you know, if I'm shut up in my office? And I'm all by myself, you know. Well, the most productive planning in the world can be going on, you know, by yourself or calling someone else in, 2 or 3 people sitting down planning. This relates to the kind of the open door policy. Many people feel like they want to be available all the time, you know. And you're sitting there by yourself doing your best planning, and you sense a presence. And you look up and there's a head, you know, sticking around the door. And you acknowledge the head and a body follows it in and sits in your chair, next to your desk. And you're interrupted. And it seems to me, if you are going to manage your time well, you have got to have some time for planning, whether it's done at home, you know, or whether it's done in the office, or wherever you are. And then if you do, you know, you're all in different situations, I realize that. This may apply more to an office. But if you do put down some time on your calendar for planning with the most important person in the world, and something interrupts it, you know, if you have an appointment with me, and you have to interrupt it, I would expect you to reschedule that. And I think the same thing is true with yourself. If you do follow this practice and something interferes, reschedule that for yourself so you do have that time for planning. I said I wanted to mention high payoff and low payoff tasks as opposed to high priority and low priority. Generally, in my opinion, priorities are set by the demands of others. You may talk about your own high priorities, but usually they're set by the demands of others. And then Suni Carlson, you remember, said, too often a manager is a puppet whose strings are drawn by a crowd of unknown and unorganized people. Well, you know, my priorities and the priorities of my boss may differ, and this sometimes comes from getting a job description about this long, like a laundry list. And he thinks I ought to be doing these, and I think I ought to be doing these, you know, and we kind of miss. So a high payoff item, as opposed to priority, is a task, well, there are very few tasks, first. Secondly, they are critical tasks, what I call a make or break item. And third, they're hard to delegate. They're something that you will have to do yourself. Now, one example, the dean in the College of Education at the University of Oregon. There were people in this large College of Ed who were saying, a high priority for us is that the dean become more visible to the troops. You know, he should come around and be seen and talk with people. Well, that was their high priority. A high payoff task for the dean was to work with the president's office to get the College of Education a top priority in the construction dollars coming to the university the next biennium of the legislature. He worked on that, and the College of Ed is number one for the University of Oregon for next year in the legislature, money that comes. Therefore, the chances are that we will get the building. Now, if he'd gone around with a high priority and meeting people, you know, we'd never have gotten this. Another high payoff task for him is to get adequate staffing for the College of Ed. He can't delegate that. Those are critical make or break items. Now, when I hold time management seminars, I usually ask those present to write out three high payoff items for themselves. You know, real critical, non-delegatable items. And then to write three low payoff items, those that are really unimportant. And guess what happens? Which do they have a harder time writing?
Low.
Yeah, everything I do is important.
High.
Yeah, if I do it, it's important. And so they, you know, write down A, B, C on the high payoff. And then they get down to the low payoff, you know, and maybe one guy writes one, and another guy sits and thinks, you know, what do I? You know, we haven't stopped to analyze the things that we do as to whether they're high or low payoff. And one of the ways to do this, and there are forms for it, is to keep your own time log during a day. Now, this sounds like a lot of busy work, but the only way you really know, you know, where your time is going is if you keep track of it during the day. And there have been cases where people have said, when someone else has kept a time log for them, that's not right. I don't spend that much of my time doing this, and so on. Well, I've kept this, and I try to keep it about 3 days, you know, every 4 or 5 months. And I found out, for example, on the certification of superintendents in Oregon, for which I'm responsible, that I spent 15% of my time in that. When I kept the record. Now, if you take 15% of the working days during the year, that's a lot of weeks. And you don't really realize some of those little things that will kind of nickel and dime you to death unless you stop to figure out where your time is going. Well, there's another important thing about identifying your high payoffs. This is a 3-star item, I think. If you're working with someone or for someone, you ought to check those high payoff items with the boss. He may think, you know, that these are high payoff items and you think these are, and you're not going to satisfy anybody in that situation. At the same time, those who work with you ought to know what your high payoff tasks are so they can help you in that area. If they're ignorant of that, they won't be able to assist. Another 3-star item is just as important to identify the low payoff items and throw them away. Those are your time robbers. Those are the things that are making you a poor steward of time. You know, those are the things that are ruining your non-renewable resource. And if planning is important, you've got to get rid of something in order to find time for that planning. Okay, I want to talk a little about delegation, because that kind of follows in this line. And I realize that you know, some of you don't have people to whom to delegate, but you may have, you know, in the future, or there may be people in home to whom you can delegate things and are not delegating tasks. Charles Percy once said, "I was so busy doing things I should have delegated, I didn't have time to manage." And that's been the story of my life, a good part of my life. So some suggestions about delegation. First, you know, it's if you're going to have time to plan, you're going to have to get rid of something. That means delegating some things. Now, this sounds kind of harsh. Someone has said, don't do anything that someone who gets paid less can do. Now, at first, that kind of sounds, you know, like, well, I'm a big shot and I shouldn't be dirtying my hands doing these things. That's not it. You're really freeing yourself to do those things for which you're responsible. And again, you're really not robbing someone else of their tasks and their responsibilities. One of the big challenges you face, there are two types of time normally we talk about, operating time and managing time. A salesman is, when he's selling, is operating. If he becomes a sales manager, he should be managing. If he likes still to be out meeting with the customers, he probably shouldn't be a sales manager. I had a principal friend out of San Diego who loves to work with kids, had a big new school. His office was right, well, his desk, if this is the main hall, his secretary sat here, and he sat right back there, because he loved to be with kids. Well, I said, George, I said, you got to decide, you know, if you want to be with kids, you want to be a teacher or a counselor. If you want to be a manager, you know, of this institution, you've got to set yourself where, give up some of these contacts. So I guess this says sometimes we get into a position or are promoted into a position that we may not like, and we have to watch out that we don't take some of those little operating things we like with us, and therefore rob the person who gets that job, you see, of what he or she is supposed to be doing. Sometimes it's good to ask an employee, you know, for what contributions, or what contributions do you think you can make to this organization? I sometimes ask the secretary this, or I ask my assistant this, or such as this. And you may be surprised. One of the things, one of these tasks that you're doing that you think, you know, only you can do, they say, well, now, you know, I could do this for you. And it's kind of a reverse way of delegation to ask some people, you know, what could you do to help out around here and get rid of some of the tasks that are now taking a lot of your time. If you do this, and when you delegate, though, those to whom you delegate must know specifically for what you're holding them responsible and what authority they have. And if you delegate something, and I know of a principal who tries to delegate, and before someone gets back to his office, you know, the principal has kind of gotten in there and meddled in that act, and people say, you know, well, why ask me to do this if you're going to come and meddle in it? Either keep it, you know, or give it to me. One of the two situations. One aid is to think of delegating as if you're going to be gone from your place for 3 months. That's a good experience.
Or go for 3 months and see what it doesn't get done. Yeah.
Well, Vern, I'd like to change that a little bit. Go for 3 months and be surprised how much gets done. That's the hurtful part, in a way. I was on a Fulbright for 2 months, and I came back to this high school, you know, and I kind of felt coming down the street, well, I wonder if the thing's in good shape, you know, and all this. And I came into the office, and I kind of said, you know, well, what are the problems, you know, what do we do now? Everything's okay, and I kind of felt let down, you know. Well, I'll get into the indispensable part in just a minute here. Okay, another two-star item, I guess. A manager's got to be willing to trust the employees and to risk somewhat. You see, if I delegate something, maybe it isn't going to be done quite as well if I give it to Bob. Or maybe I'm concerned because I think I can do it better. But how do I know what abilities he has until he has a chance to work at this for a while? He may do a better job than I do. But let's say that he doesn't, that he does it at a 90% level. Now, at the expense of my planning time, should I continue to do that, you know, for just a little increment? Or should I really say, hey, that job is getting done well, not as good as, you know, but I have time for planning. Unless you've got adequate time, you've got to be delegating these things to other people. You've got no choice but to do that. Then, as a manager or as a parent, as a trustee, as a director, I don't care what it is, you've got to look out for upward delegation. I call it upbucking. Someone has put it this way. Everyone that comes in to see you, or lots of people that come in to see you, have a monkey on their back. And your task is to see that when they leave your office or your area, that they still have the monkey on their back, or pretty soon you'll have a whole room full of monkeys. And I've got an overhead that this depicts this pretty well, you know, a guy at his desk and monkeys all over the place. But you see, this was my misunderstanding of a good-hearted approach and a helping approach to everybody. It isn't necessarily helpful if you come in with a problem, you know, and I solve it for you, because you aren't getting to grow at that point. And the best thing I can do is to say, what is your opinion? And if you don't have one, say, well, why don't you go out and think about this and come in tomorrow and give me some alternatives and what you think is your best opinion. You grow in the process. I don't, you know, waste my time meddling in these things. And then if you're in the same situation I was in, you know, taking these and feeling I had to have an answer and all that type of thing, think about this. Maybe I'm doing this, maybe you're doing that because you want to kind of be needed. You know, maybe you're encouraging it indirectly by, yeah, bring me your problems and I'll help you with them. But if you're going to have time to plan and time to manage, you're going to have to avoid some of that. One of the most important persons, of course, if you're in an office, is a secretary. And some people, I talk to some secretaries and they say, oh, I wish he'd tell me what he's planning to do today. I wish I could get in there, you know, for 5 or 10 minutes and find out what the important things are today and so on. And, you know, either end, there needs to be some communication. I try to tell Mona, you know, when I come in, well, come on in, let's start the day together and figure out what's important and so on. So she knows what's in my mind, because I do some work at home and I may have some ideas and we're out of synchronization. This idea of non-delegation, I think, springs a lot from the feeling of indispensability. And as someone has said, the cemeteries are full of indispensable people. A kind of a myth of omnipotence, I guess. And there's a poem I like that I think I can say, although I jotted down some notes about it here, that fits this. Sometime when you're feeling important, sometime when your ego's in bloom, sometime when you take it for granted that you're the most important one in the room, take a bucket and fill it with water. Put your hand in it up to the wrist. Take it out, and the hole that's remaining is the measure of how you'll be missed. You may splash all you wish as you enter. You may stir up the water galore, but stop, and in just a few minutes, it will look much the same as before. Now, the moral of this little story is to do the best that you can. Be proud of yourself, but remember, there's no indispensable man or person. Man, if you want to be rhyming. I remember when I worked for an aircraft company, early World War II, I was in charge of personnel, and I got sick and I stayed on the job, you know, and finally I had to go home. I was too sick, and I said to somebody, well, just call me, you know, on the telephone, I'll be near the phone. I went home and I kind of laid in a half-ready position and answered the phone. And after a while I said, Erickson, you fool, you know, if you die, they're still going to go on making those airplane parts. But somehow we can get to feeling, you know, very indispensable to what we're doing. And I guess I would just have to state that if we feel indispensable, it may be because of two things. We were in an organization that was small to begin with, and it grew and grew and grew, you know, and I was on the top of it to begin with, and as it grew, I was still responsible, but I was hanging on because by habit I continued to do lots of the things that I used to have to do. Whereas if I kind of get away, you know, and look at this, I've got to say, hey, Ken, you know, you can't do all those things. You've got to take this and find out, you know, who can do this, take this task, you know, can you do this, and so on. If you get into problems, come and see me. If you run into a policy measure, you know, come and see me. If you come into a budget problem, you want to spend more money than's budgeted, you know, come and see me. But otherwise, you know, that's your pasture. And too many times we give somebody, you know, a pasture, an area to work in, or a place to build their sandcastles, and then we reach in, you know, and change the model while they're working on it. And this is hard on their morale, very hard. The best thing we can do is to give them a job, trust them, risk a little bit. It may not be quite as good, but in the long run, you know, they feel a lot more successful. So I've said sometimes I'd rather have be a pole beam coming out of the ground to an 8-foot pole than a 4-foot pole. I'd rather be challenged. And most of the people that work with us or for us, you know, are capable individuals who want to be challenged, who want to help, and carry their share of the load. Well, our time has about gone, and I think some of you want to get over to First Lunch. So if there are some individuals who want to make some comments now or raise some questions, feel free, and the rest of you are free to move on.